pleasure to be here with you again tonight. Mission Conference has several purposes. And, of course, there's inspirational preaching, and there's some convicting preaching, we hope. And there's several brothers doing that every night. And we also need to give some insight of what we've done and where we're going. And that takes place from time to time and through the messages and sometimes the ladies touching that. And tonight I want to go of some of the challenges we've faced. Over, I've been in Mexico now. It'll be Monday. It'll be 24 years to the day. I left Michigan and headed south. And there's some things that have impressed me as we've gone through these years in Mexico. Is there's some challenges and some things that are continuing. Things don't change that often, and so a lot of these things are still a point of prayer for you that you pray for us as we meet some of these various challenges. And turn, if you would, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 19 to 22. Gives an insight that from Paul's point of view, that he faced these challenges every day and everywhere he went. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we'll start reading in verse 19. "For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might again gain the more. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without the law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them which are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." Amen. Going from a very conservative, rigid type upbringing as I had on the farm in Michigan to Mexico, which is entirely different, put many things to my light that maybe some of the other missionaries didn't see. And so I'd like to go through some of them maybe chronologically. In San Luis, the first time that I went there some 24 years ago, the first thing that I noticed right off was there was no punctuality in the people there. They didn't care what time you said it was going to start. They're coming when they want to. And it's, to me, it just shows a lack of interest. It shows a disconcern for other people. It's very selfish. We had a gentleman there in one of the churches that he began to take a rotation in the preaching. And when it was his turn to preach Sunday morning, he was on time. And all the other times, he would come in late. And I confronted him on that. And he said, "Well, I have to be on time when I preach, because I'm preaching." And I said, "Do you realize how selfish that is, that you don't think anyone else is worth listening to?" That, and he eventually was taken out of the rotation. And it showed just very clearly that he's not that much interested in the work. And that was a real shock to me. Not only are they late when they get there, they have this thing, they have to be so polite and greet everybody. We had our meetings in the beginning in Brother Dale's house, and there's 60 to 70 people in this living room and dining room area, tiny little hallway type thing, and there's a stairway, and we got the kids all lined up on the stairway, and they come in 30 minutes late, and you got to go around and greet everybody. The guy's preaching, the guy's in the middle of a sermon, and he goes around and greets everybody. I haven't succumbed that's not important to be on time, and we still demand it. We preach it. We say you're just a visitor unless you can be here on time. And even if you come to every meeting but you come late, you're still not considered a member of the church until you're punctual. And that was one of the big things. Another thing I saw there was they're pretty reluctant to participate. They just real, I don't know if it's fear, I don't know what, but they stand back and wait for, well, in that case, it was the gringos, wait for the gringos to step in and do the work. And they were that way in practical things. If something needed to be set up, the chairs and whatnot, it was usually the Americans that did it, because they just were reluctant to step in and be a part of it. And that's a real challenge. We're trying to get people to get involved, and they just didn't have that natural, let me help, let me move things. And I really saw that in San Luis in the beginning. And also that carried over into spiritual things. We had open meetings, and the Americans would get up and share. Even some of the American kids would get up and share. And we finally, amongst ourselves, said, "We're not going to say anything. You mission people, you've got a Bible, you bring something. And we sat in dead silence for a long time. Nobody would get it. They're just real reluctant to make a commitment to get involved. And I really noticed these things. I'm from the birthplace of productivity. Henry Ford and the mass production. My uncles were timekeepers. They were time study. they timed. We had reunions, and it was all a race to see who could do whatever faster. And then to go to a place where it's just completely opposite was a real shock. And how do you get anything done? You know, if it didn't get done fast, it didn't get done, is my opinion. And so. It was one of those rough times. We moved on to León, and there everything changes. The cities we've learned have a personality. Every place is different, and you think you got it understood, and you think things are going to go well because you've done something here. Get to the next city, it's a whole other thing, and it's another training session, another time to figure out what these people are like and what it takes to be what they need. We started out in León, and we had tremendous resistance. It was, some of you that have been around here a while, you've heard about all the tremendous persecution. It was pretty bad. There was little old ladies throwing rocks at us. There was priests giving little boys bread to go and throw rocks at us. We've had knives pulled on us, dogs sicked on us, guns stuck in our face, shotguns and pistols, and just tremendous resistance. We had the campaign, the preachings downtown where the image seller of the town was there leading his band of drug addicts and dopies and anybody that wanted to push around an American. He brought down a mariachi band one night and had paid them to march around the preacher and bang on the drums and the trumpets and everything. And Joey was preaching at the time. So Joey just went for a walk. Preaching. He's just preaching away, and these guys are following him. And he takes his great big circle out around several blocks, so he doesn't know where he went. And so we finished up preaching then in silence, and pretty soon we could hear the music, and Joey was running out of voice, and here come the... One night, so the guy saw that wasn't working, and paying the mariachi, so he showed up with a boombox, big old radio, and he walked around with this thing blaring, and that was the kind of thing we went through for several years. And after we left, the Mexican brothers then really got in the resistance, as the Americans have and I'll touch on that Thursday night. The Americans have got a little more clout. You arrest an American, and you're supposed to call the embassy. They don't want an international incident. We've got a real advantage, I believe, over some of the Mexican brothers. And after we left, they started going to jail and spending the night. It was a rougher time for them. Another thing we found in León was great hospitality. Brent remembers that, I'm sure. We went up to this colony to preach, and everybody come out, and they were interested. We had this great campaign, and they all wanted to invite you in to eat something. And that's where I learned about all the moles and the pozoles and panza, tacos de panza and all. And their hospitality, they had a good heart, but they sure didn't know how to cook. They just...
They didn't know what to cook.
Yeah, they didn't know what to cook. You know, it's... My introduction to pozole was these two kids were fighting over something. And I said, what are they fighting over? I said, they're fighting over the ear of the pig. And it's my ear. No, it's my ear. And these two little kids pulling each other around, you know. Cut the thing in two and both of you chew on it, you know. And that was... But they wanted to feed us. And when I left León after 5 years, I had a zoo in my stomach. And I was over a year. I was over a year fighting the parasites. We were in a colonia that had not been paved. It hadn't even, all they had was meter numbers. They still had even put the house numbers on. Hadn't even incorporated it yet. And these people lived in shacks that you wouldn't believe in. And it's quite an eye-opener to see what people would call home. We went to one house, Brent and I did, to have a Bible study. Even remembers that clearly, probably. This crippled man is laying on this pile of trash, what he called his bed. The rat is looking out at us. It's a dirt floor down the hill. You got a broomsticks are purposely hung from the ceiling where the chickens roost. And these women were in there, and they had to cook us something. I believe it's the only place that I turned down a meal. When they've shooed the chickens off the pots and pans to begin to... that was where the chicken landed on your head. Remember that? He's giving a study. This chicken lands on his head, and he's trying to get a point to this guy. And I'm serious. And Britt says, no, he's all right. He's not bothering me. Look at this. That's what happened to his hair, you know. We had the one lady, many of you heard about her, Raina. She lived in two little unfinished rooms, had a picket fence type deal for the gate to the backyard where her pig lived. And she literally stood at the stove and flipped her cuttings and things, her throwaways, into this pig right there. And he'd stick his head over and grunt when he wanted a little more. And this is in the house. And so she invited us over one day for carnitas. And carnitas are pretty, they boil it, they cook this in fat, you know, and it's really hot, and so it kills most. Okay, well, go have carnitas. And as we walked up, there's people sitting in chairs she'd borrowed from the neighbors on both sides of the walkway into the kitchen area of what she called her house, and the blood of that pig is running right out in the street. And she killed that pig in the kitchen floor, and then they're throwing it into this big vat, and that was the carnitas of the day. And all things to all men, you know. give me some of that with lots of hot sauce. And we found out in Lyon that these people were free thinkers. They get an idea, they see something biblical, but they think on their own. And we finally got to the point, we had some people meeting with us, and does someone here want to take charge of bringing us the Lord's table? And we've had several, a year or so of example from the missionary ladies bringing the bread and the cup. So this family, they want to be included. They were one of those that wanted to do, but they're free thinkers. And we'll do it. And they came with this great big thing covered up, and they pulled it off, and it's pancakes cut in the shape of fish. They had went and made a cookie cutter out of tin, the shape of a fish, and brought us... all they get is a little scrap. We want them to have something to... So we all got this piece of fish, and we're... You know, what do you do? Where do you knock them down and say you're... Some decisions that are pretty tough to take, you know, what you have to make. And you're going to make an issue out of this. When are you going to deal with this? You blame yourself for not going over and showing exactly what you have to have, you know. Just some of the practical problems we ran into. Like the time Brother Brent preached a really good message on there's no difference between the Jew and the Greek, or the man or the woman, that matter of fact. And he got all done preaching this. He just picked a bad time, just before the Lord's table. So the ladies jumped up, and they broke the bread. They passed the thing. So now, you remember that? So then what do you do? You know, he just said there's no difference. What do you mean? What do you mean you're telling me I'm not let the men do this? So then we have to figure a way to correct the issue without offending these women who took him seriously, you know. The message then was, you men are so shameful because you won't get up and do and the women have to do your job, was the reply. But it took a while to figure that one out. One of the things that was a real blessing to me in Lyon was this church, more than anyone that I've seen, won their families. The first young lady to get saved, a girl named Blanca, her two sisters are missionary wives. We work with one, and another one's in Guadalajara with her husband. But she won her mother, and he won her brother. Another lady, Bill, dealt with a Juan, most of her family has been saved. Just one example after another, and to me that makes a big impression on me. We were in another church that they did win their family. A lot of people got saved, a lot of young people got saved, but not many of the family. A brother and sister got saved simultaneously. But other than that, it was one here and one there, and then they never brought their families in. And sad to say, most of those people aren't active anymore in the church. And so, Leon was a real blessing to see that. And I'm concerning how do we promote these people to help impress upon the people we do get saved that you need to win your families. And that's a point of prayer that we know how to deal with these people. You need to win your families. You need to get evangelism starts at home, and then we moved to Aguascalientes. We had tremendous opposition. We actually had tremendous interest in León, in Aguascalientes. I didn't see any interest at all. They didn't care one way or another. They would ignore you and walk by you. One time Joey was preaching, he shouted the same phrase over and over and over again, trying to get somebody to stop. And finally somebody did, and then he tried to finish his message, but they just weren't interested. And, boy, that's so much harder than being persecuted. It's nobody interested. They just walk by, and it was hard plowing, and you just keep breaking the ground until finally some people did get saved, and there are actually two meeting places there in Aguascalientes. Another thing that we saw in Aguas, and we also saw in León, was the opposition from other Christians. And you know, you're actually doing what it actually says.
Yeah.
You're actually preaching. You're actually taking it literally what it says, and you get a knock on the door, and it's the Christian Council of Pastors at your door, and they say, "Hey, you guys are messing this all up for us. You guys can't be doing. You need to get people to be your friend and take them in a building, and there in secret you tell them about images and you tell them about Mary worship and you tell them about their sin, but don't do it in the streets." And Bill had a big talk with that one bunch, and as it came down to it, the problem was is that the city had been loaning them certain buildings to use for meetings and for gatherings, and now they didn't want to because they associated those Christians with us. And it happened again in Aguascalientes, the same thing. One brother that came to ask us to quit preaching, to ask us to be more considerate of the problems it was causing them, Brent told him, he says, "Well, if this is a problem, then we'll go to the city and we'll tell them that we're the ones doing this. Don't hold us against them." And this one brother came and said, "No, you guys are preaching. I don't do that." He says, "Well, I'll put up with it." And to me, that was encouraging to see that somebody actually was willing to stand with the gospel rather than stand against it. But boy, that's a real knockdown to you when you think these are the friends. Puts me on the other side of the equation sometimes, and we need to be careful not to bash these other brothers that we don't agree with, but they might be our best friends if they're saved and born again, and we don't steal from their churches. We don't. If somebody comes and says they're already saved, we drill them on their salvation. If they are clear, then you need to get back to your congregation and be faithful. And we've actually told people, you can't meet with us. Because you're already saved. God put you in a place. You get back there and do. Amen. Yeah, but we like what you're doing. Well, then get over there and do it. But don't. You're not going to do it here. And that kind of came out of that episode. We then returned to San Luis. I call it San Luis 2. It was when Michael had went over. And he and Marco started preaching downtown with a couple of the Mexican brothers from Seleni. Seleni wasn't preaching that time in the open air. And they went down, and this young boy that's had this motorcycle accident and was one of the first ones to get saved in that, him and his sister. And six people got saved in the first couple weeks of preaching there. And Michael and I were planning on going to Querétaro at that time. And he said, "Dad, I'm not going. I'm not. I got something's already started here." So we stayed. There were several things. First, it was the most interest we ever saw in our preaching in the plazas. People were coming and were waiting for us every night to hear us preach, older people. And they sat attentively to listen. They listened to what we had to say. And we know that because later we divided into groups, the young people that were there, and had discussions and debates, even arguments. But they were always asking, "You said this. Where does it say that? How can you say that? They had been listening. And if somebody came and tried to disrupt, which happened a few times, they were the first ones to step up and say, "Hey, we're listening to this. You be quiet." They controlled the crowd for us. And there was sometimes 50, 100, 100 people that were there and listened to the gospel for nearly 2 years. It might have been because it was all young people. We had 14, 15, 16-year-olds preaching the gospel boldly, and they were gifted. That was one of the things that was, they were so gifted. They understood the first pass-through. One of the girls understood on her own study that, that baptism and circumcision was the is the same type. Says that's what it's talking about. And put it all together on her own. And these young men were gifted with doctrine and explaining it and were clear. With that gift and that zeal came a lot of arrogance. And I'm at fault. I was sucked right into it. Man, this is great. These guys are great. I should have been more mature to realize these guys are too young to handle this and worked harder at humbling rather than exalting. But their arrogance, I think, got us into trouble. Our arrogance. And we've had many losses. A lot of these gifted young men, they went off into the, they got into their careers, they got into their lifestyles, and so we've had a tremendous amount of loss in all this. And that's one of the sad parts of San Luis. One of the things that we had also a real hard decision, and that's something that's a point of prayer for you to us, we had a lot of opposition from the parents. We had a young man who had just turned 16. He was preaching. He wanted to be a part of the ministry, and his parents said, "You cannot go." He refused to let him go. At what age do we say, "Hey, tell your parents you're going to live your life and walk out. Just follow the Lord." And he came to me and wanted me to give him a job and let him sleep on my couch, and he was going to leave home. My decision was, no, I'm not going to make it easy on you. If you want to leave home, you get a job, you find a place to live where you pay the rent, and you keep going to school and support yourself. And if you're willing to do that, then God will bless it. If you're not willing to take those steps and put out that much effort, "Oh, but it's so hard to go to school." I said, "School don't cost you nothing. Even college doesn't. It costs more to get to college than the college tuition is. The transportation is more than college tuition." I says, "All you got to do is wash 5 or 6 cars every morning, and you can go to school in the afternoon. You can support yourself, live on your own. It's just a matter if you want to or not." He did for a year and a half. Finished high school, washing cars, and he eventually, another Christian group picked him up, and he's going to, he went to some seminary on the East Coast. I have lost track of it. I don't know what has happened to him. But when do you tell a young man or young lady, it's time for you to step on your own? When do you say, "You know, you're still under mom and dad, and you need to stay there"? And that's an answer I don't have. But we had a lot of that, quite a bit of that. Marco is one of those, but he was already 20 years old, and so it was pretty easy with him. But we had several in the church, 15, 16 years old, right in that range. Then I was in Querétaro for a while. Michael and Adrian had things pretty well going time I got there, and I really wasn't involved in too much, but I was really impressed with some men that the Lord sent. Some men that wanted to be a part. Michael used the example that your champion, your hero, is the one that wants the ball. If you got 3 seconds to play, you want somebody to take it that wants it. You don't want to force it on. You want somebody that wants it, and he'll be the hero. And this is the kind of teaching that Michael put in these guys. Says, if you want to do something, Lord, you got to desire the opportunity. You got to desire to carry it. And there's several there that have, and they want to be a part. We had an election for deacons, and what it simply is every man in the church that is a giver writes on a card who he would feel comfortable with, or who he'd say can handle my money in the church. And if you get 100% of your, everybody turns in their cards, and if it's 100%, then that one's a deacon. That's how we did the election. And by the way, the one who wrote down the name, the one with the card, had to put his name on it. It's not an anonymous. If you vote for somebody, they're going to say, "How come you put his name on there?" You're going to get confronted. Nothing's secret. And the one guy there, he put his name on me. I want to be a deacon. That's what I want to do. I want to serve this church. And that's the kind of attitude that we run into that. The problem is that these men are all saved late in life. So we had a meeting, and there's 15 men, married men, with their, they have their family in, they have their children, they have a business, they have work. We need to put a bank account in somebody's name. Who here would be willing to put a bank account in your name? They're all willing. Not one of them, of 15 men, had a pass that would allow them to. If you put bank account in my name, somebody's going to find out that it's there in my name and they'll come after it. They got so much trouble in their past, so much baggage, that they couldn't even put a bank account in their name. And that's the kind of problems we run into. Ended up, had to put the bank account in a woman's name or in a gringo, and that's not acceptable. We don't want to be known as the ones, we're not down there for the money. We're not, so end up being a woman's name. Is it now in a man's name?
No.
It's still not. So these are real problems. And that's what we face day to day in nearly all these churches. I come to the conclusion, and I mentioned it the other night, that we're preparing for the next generation. We're praying and teaching that the children of these men will have no regrets, living with no regrets, and having a testimony and a stability that they can actually be the ones to lead out in these churches. You don't go down to a corrupt and wicked culture and one day to the next have what you take for granted here in the States. That's Isaac and Manuel, two young men. One is the son of the elder that's there, and another young man got saved through the preaching and just really blossomed, and they're both missionaries sent out of that church now in Pachuca with us. One got married the day we came up here, and another one too just a month before. So they got fine Christian wives. They didn't fall in love. They went and picked a woman that would wanted to serve the Lord and had been faithful. They'd been out both of these young ladies had been out faithfully with the preachers, passing out tracts and witnessing downtown. And they wanted a godly man for a husband. They wanted to serve the Lord full time, and so they said that's the one I want, and went and. And the courtships are about like Bill and Debbie's, you know, a week long, and it's a real blessing. But that's a second generation, and that I believe is the hope of Mexico, the second and third generations. We then went to Pachuca, and there it was a whole other set of rules. Another set of deals. The first thing that really bothered us was the cell phones. Now, when I was a while back, I got a cell phone. One of the first, and I felt real bad wearing a cell phone, like showing off. I got a cell phone. So I wouldn't take it downtown. I'd hide it, put it under my coat, something. And now everybody has cell phones. Kids, 8 years old in Taylor's school, take their cell phones to school that they got for Christmas. You know, and it's everywhere. But in the meetings. We got these cell phones ringing, and these people are getting up and going over and talking. And they're not just shutting it off. They're going over and talking. They come back and wait for the next ring. And it's two or three times the same one, you know. We make big spiel about it and turn them off. And, you know, we're going to start collecting them at the door. If we had a door, of course, we're in the park. But another thing that hit us right off, more than I've seen in the other places, that most of these people are married, but not to each other. This one couple, are you guys married? Yeah, we're married. And then later on in the conversation, they come up, well, I'm not married to him, and I'm not married to her. We each have, and they've been living 14 years. They've got four kids. After 14 years, so it's a set of problems that, what do you do now? And, you got to get this straightened out. Well, my ex has got her husband and, her man and her children, but she don't want to get a divorce because it looked bad in the Catholic Church. You know, and so if she won't give the divorce and then, you know, they're dirt poor. It is going to take anything that you want done in Mexico is going to cost a lot of money. They're going to have to sacrifice a tremendous amount to get a legal divorce and then so they can actually remarry. We did have a real encouragement. We had a young couple that came up, and and they talked. This is my wife. This is my husband. And so I never even questioned it. You know, they were just a young couple, and he's 20, and she was 17, I think, 18, I don't know, whatever. And so I just, you know, they made it real clear, and she was from a Christian background, supposedly. But then we was looking through the pictures, and there was no wedding pictures. I was at their house, and, well, when did you guys get married? Well, we decided to be married, but we never got married. And so you said this, your husband and your wife. Says, well, we've made this commitment. I said, yeah, but it's not legal and it's not right, and God demands that. So they went through the whole thing, and so he sent her home. He says, you're right. And he sent her home. He got saved, and then he went back and married her, and they're there in the church now. But we were impressed that he was willing to take the steps. Because you're right. You're right. Let's do this right. And he packed her up and sent her right home. And says, I'll get enough money to take care of things, and I'll come get you. And that's what they did. Another thing we found in Pachuca that we've seen in a lot of places, but it's really been rampant in Pachuca, is people that come right up to us as, I'm so-and-so, and I'm a Christian. I'm saved. And so we go through our little spiel to find out and drill them, and they haven't got a clue. They don't know. They're trusting in a baptism. They're trusting in their works. Somebody came through and confused the way. What I talked about Tuesday night. They just confused the path. They don't know. They have no idea what salvation is. It's just that somebody says, we've got you wet, and now you're saved. Or you're on the right road because now you're meeting with us and whatever. And so, and that's hard because now they have terminology that's more dangerous to know than not to know. It's easier to get somebody saved that doesn't think he's saved than someone that thinks he is. And so a lot of our dealings are convincing people that they really aren't saved. And, of course, that's usually offensive. What do you mean? You know, so-and-so told me, well, if you don't have a biblical basis for your own sake, take the negative side that I need to know and start over. But that's been one of the things that we've had to fight with. One of the things in general overall is just the broken promises. These people would lie to you and lie to you just not to offend you at the moment. Susan and I invited a family over, family in the church, to come over for dinner. And they won't tell you no. Even if they know they got a wedding to go to, they got somebody's funeral they're going to, and they're not going to be able to come. They say, oh, yeah, we'll be there. She fixed this big meal, set it all up on the table, and we're waiting, and we're waiting, and we're waiting. They never showed up. They'd rather give you an excuse later than tell you the truth beforehand. And that makes it pretty tough to take these guys very serious when they live in a lie and will look you right in the eye and lie to you about something that doesn't even matter, much less when you're getting serious about spiritual things. So we're real cautious not to lead them to say something about being saved or about accepting the Lord. This is something you got to do on your own. You got to come back and tell us on another time. They won't come back and start the lie up again, but you can get them to say anything at the moment. And I think that's where a lot of evangelists go wrong, especially in Mexico, is they can get them to say anything at any time. And we need to be real careful that we're not playing on a fault in their character, a fault in their upbringing, and that they really do know the Lord Jesus Christ when they say they do. That's all I had written down for those things. And I just want to say I appreciate you folks for your sacrifice to us and your offerings and your prayers. And these are some of the things we deal with daily. There's still some other things, I'm sure, but we do need your prayer, and this maybe give you an idea what to pray for. Amen.